Professor Strauss, Political Philosophy of Plato. Session 2, March 31st, 1965.
Now we will begin with can you close the door, please? I tried to explain last time that the Gorgias presents a rhetorical discussion of rhetoric. Gorgias is the master of rhetoricians, rhetoric, and Gorgias' view of rhetoric do not come to sight owing to the handicaps from which he suffers, his being tired and so on. But these handicaps were arranged by Plato. Why does Plato not wish to bring out Gorgias' rhetoric and his view of rhetoric? This is a question. Plato does bring out Socrates' view of rhetoric, as well as Socrates' rhetorical practice. We do not know, however, how Socrates' view of rhetoric would have to be revised in the light of Gorgias' view, which is unknown. Plato makes invisible something of importance. He abstracts from it. We have to find out from what he abstracts and why he does this. In other words, Plato demands critical readers. He knows, of course, that not all readers are critical and can be critical. Those who cannot be critical will simply accept or reject what Socrates says. Plato makes us realize what one can call the stratification of the readers. Or, to use a vaguer term, the variety of human beings. This knowledge, branch of knowledge, is called psychology. Psychology is already a Greek word, psychologia, and it is connected in Plato with something else which he calls psychagogia, guiding of the souls. Now, this knowledge of the soul, or of the souls and their guidance, is the basis of the political art. Contrary to the view which Socrates suggests in the Gorgias, that the fundamental part of the political art is a legislative art. The legislative art itself must ultimately be based on knowledge of the variety of souls. It must be based on psychology, or in order to avoid some misunderstandings, let us say psychologia, lest we mistake it for what is now academic psychology. Socrates' explicit view of rhetoric is to the effect that rhetoric is a kind of flattery, a sham imitation of punitive justice. Punitive justice being here understood as the art of restoring the health of the soul. This view of rhetoric is based on the premise that suffering injustice is better than doing injustice, whereas rhetoric itself is based on the view that suffering injustice is worse than doing injustice. Now, Socrates argues this matter out with Polus, as we have seen, and after he has refuted Polus, he says that rhetoric is good only for self-accusation, in other words, for your own liberation from injustice, which implies, of course, that rhetoric is not simply flattery, because if it can have such a good effect. Socrates also forces raise a question which he does not bring up here. Why should rhetoric be used and not be used for just self-defense, which after all would seem to be a legitimate purpose. The answer to this question is this. Socrates is concerned only with justice, with, i.e. with one's being just, and not with the other goods, like life, freedom, fame, and so on. He abstracts from them. The very distinction between flattery and art is based on the fundamental distinction between the pleasant and the good, in such a way that the art, rational procedure, can never have anything to do with the promotion of pleasure. We can also say here what is effective here is an abstraction from pleasure. Poulos is refuted in that sense that he is shown to contradict himself. His self-contradiction is of importance because it is a typical one. Ordinarily, men cannot make up their minds as to what is the greatest good, justice, or life, freedom, wealth, and fame. Commonsensically, we would, of course, say both are goods, but the question is, which has the right of way in a case of conflict, which is the greatest good? And most human beings would, of course, say, if they are not compelled to choose, that justice is the highest good, but if they are compelled to choose, they might prefer life, liberty, and so on, to justice. However this may be, Poulos's refutation by Socrates is not a proof of the view that justice is the highest good. It is merely a proof that Poulos contradicts himself. Socrates, however, claims that the refutation of Poulos is a proof of the view that justice is the highest good. This is unsatisfactory, and therefore the true discussion begins only at this moment, and at that moment, namely when Callicles enters, in the third part, which is more than the second half of the dialogue. Now let us see how Callicles enters, and we cannot possibly read this all. That is only you have the. I have it here.
Yes, I have the four.
Do you have? You have the.
Yeah, I have the gorgeous. Socrates, you seem to me to be going mad with eloquence.
No, that is, roughly, but let me say a few more words before we come to that. Now, Callicles is completely bewildered. Does Socrates mean what he says? Can he mean what he says? For if Socrates were serious, our whole way of life would be completely wrong. Callicles grasps the bearing of Socrates' assertion, which Poulos didn't grasp because he was in the midst of the argument. Callicles is more open-minded than Poulos. And connected with this, the question concerns now no longer merely rhetoric, but our whole life. He is more serious than Poulos and Gorgias. We can say he is not lukewarm, just as Socrates is not lukewarm. Socrates and Callicles share something which they do not share with Poulos and Gorgias. Now what is that? Now let us begin with this long speech of Socrates in 482c.
Socrates. Callicles, if human beings did not have certain feelings,
yes,
in common, though they may vary a bit from man to man, if each of us had merely his own private sensations unshared by the rest, it would not be easy to demonstrate to another what one feels.
Yeah, to show, demonstrate is perhaps too technical in meaning, to reveal to the other one's own feeling. In other words, Socrates does not suggest a doctrine of empathy.
Yeah.
In passing, the question: how do we understand other human beings? A great question in modern times, and the most common answer is empathy possible. This is tacitly rejected as well. We understand each other because of a fundamental identity of our natures, and then how do we find out? Well, we talk. We talk with other human beings, and then we see how much we have in common and also what the differences are. Yes? So, but now, what is the meaning, the purpose of this remark here, the general remark here?
I say this with reference to the fact that at the moment you and I are both experiencing somewhat the same emotion, and each of us has two objects of his love. I, Alcibiades, the son of Clinias, and philosophy. You, the Athenian Demos, and the son of Pyrilampes. Now I have...
This is a little joke. The son of Pyrilampes had the name Demos, just as the Demos. Yeah. Yes.
Now I have noticed that in each instance, whatever your favorite says, however his opinions may go, for all your cleverness, you are unable to contradict him, but constantly shift back and forth at his whim. If you are making a speech in the assembly and the Athenian Demos disagrees, you change and say what it desires. And in the presence of this beautiful young son of Pyrilampes, your experience is precisely similar.
Yes. Now, what is the pathos, the experience, the feeling, which Socrates and Callicles share, and which by implication Gorgias and Polos do not share? It is called Eros. Now, Eros, in other words, where we would speak of a particular seriousness, of dedication, Socrates speaks of Eros. He means something different, probably different from what we ordinarily mean by Eros. Is that a seriousness, possibly a deadly seriousness, can go with Eros is, I think, still remembered in our time. At any rate, it's surely not something lukewarm. But, as Socrates makes clear immediately, while they share these patterns, they love different things, different youths, and different matters, affairs. Socrates loves philosophy, and Callicles loves the Athenian Demos. It seems that the two things are mutually exclusive. No, you must note that he says Callicles loves the Athenian Demos. He doesn't say that Callicles loves democracy. It's very important. He loves the Athenian Demos, this particular Demos here. Now, how come hitherto we have seen Socrates as a lover of justice? And what is implied here is that the love of justice becomes necessarily philosophy, love of wisdom. Now, what about the alternative? Love of injustice leads to love of the Athenian Demos. That is not quite clear. There is some link missing. Love of injustice leads to love of some particular being, like the Demos. Well, the link is very simple. Right or wrong, my country. If you take ordinarily selfishness, how it leads to injustice, that is easy to see. But if you replace simple selfishness by collective selfishness, then it is no longer so clearly visible, because then you can say you dedicate yourself to something greater than you. But the question is whether that is sufficient. whether it's a principle right or wrong, my community, my country is sufficient. Now, Socrates claims here, in other words, that his procedure, or his preceding argument, was philosophic. Callicles, however, denies this. Now let us turn to Callicles' speech, the leading of the end.
Socrates, you seem to me to be going mad with eloquence, like a true politician. And now you are prattling this way because Polus has fallen victim to the very treatment which he accused Gorgias of having received at your hands. What you said, I believe, that when Gorgias was questioned by you as to whether, when anyone came to him desiring to learn rhetoric, but without a knowledge of justice, Gorgias grew ashamed and said he would teach him, complying with conventional morality. Because people might grow...
Well, literally because of the custom of human beings. Yeah. There is no word for morality in Greek.
Because of the custom of human beings. Because people might grow indignant if he said he wouldn't, and it was through this very admission that he was forced to contradict himself, which is exactly what you were so fond of. On this occasion, Polus was laughing at you, and rightly too, I think. But now, in his turn, he has suffered this same fate. From my point of view, what I cannot approve of in Polus' performance is precisely this. He conceded to you that doing wrong is uglier than suffering it, and it was from this concession that he got completely tangled up in the argument, and, being ashamed to say what he really thought, had his mouth gagged. Now, Socrates, you know you really do divert the argument into such cheap and vulgar paths, saying that you're pursuing the truth, but really getting us into what is beautiful not by nature, but by convention. Yet these two are for the most part opposed to each other, nature and convention. So that if a man is timid and doesn't have the courage to speak his mind, he must necessarily contradict himself.
Now let us stop here for one moment there. Now, Socrates had claimed that his procedure was philosophical. Callicles denies this. Socrates' procedure was vulgarly rhetorical. That is the point. Vulgarly, and what is the rhetorical trick consisted? Socrates simply exploited Gorgias' fear of popular disapproval, and Polus's too, or he exploited their sense of shame. Socrates acted as a vulgar rhetorician by arguing on the basis of convention as distinguished from nature. And then he develops his own thesis. Callicles' own thesis at some length in the immediate. Let us read only a few more sentences where you left off.
So this is the clever trick you have devised to cheat in your arguments. If a man makes his assertions according to convention, in your questions you slyly substitute according to nature. And if he speaks according to nature, you reply according to convention. So in the present instance, when doing and suffering wrong were being examined, Polus spoke of what was uglier according to convention, but you followed it up as though it were a natural principle. By nature, in fact, everything that is worse is uglier, just as suffering wrong is, but to do wrong is uglier merely by convention. For to suffer wrong is not the part of a man at all, that of a slave, for whom it is better to be dead than alive, as it is for anyone who is unable to come either to his own assistance when he is wronged or mistreated, or to that of anyone he cares about. I can quite imagine that the manufacturers of laws and conventions are the weak, the majority, in fact.
Yeah, let us stop here. The words which uses this, it is not a matter of a man. In Greek, anea. The nearest modern equivalent of which I know is hombre. It is not English, but intelligent. And the word we use, anthropos, from which anthropology and such words are derived, it means a human being and has a lower sense in Greek. I mean, an anthropos is a human being who is not an hombre, for example, a slave or some low-class man. Now, let us see what he says. Suffering injustice is better than doing injustice. This assertion is merely the assertion of the nomos, of convention. According to nature, the opposite is true. Doing injustice is by nature both better and nobler than suffering injustice. But not all men are capable of living in accordance with nature. Only hombres can, in contradistinction to the weak and many human beings. And the nomos, the convention, is the work of the many weaklings. And he develops then in the sequel, they set up equality in contradistinction to having more as a norm. And they do it for a very good reason as far as they are concerned. Because for them, equality is an improvement. Naturally, because they are no longer exposed to the greater power and cleverness of the superior men. This right of the stronger is a right of nature. Even the law of nature, that is the first time the word the law of nature occurs, and it is here used paradoxically, because nature and law are antithetic to each other. How can there be a law of nature? The meaning here is that Callicles is so much, without knowing it, under the spell of political conventions, that he cannot conceive of the right of nature except in some legal terms, the law of nature. This explanation wouldn't explain the other use of the term law of nature in Plato, which is in the Timaeus, but we are not now concerned with this. Natural right surpasses conventional right by its splendor. And this splendor is due to that of the superior man. And this is developed with great force by Callicles in the sequel. Now this passage has reminded modern readers of some remarks of Nietzsche about the superior man, but there is very little in common between Callicles and Nietzsche. And the very simple reason is that Callicles is, as all Greeks were, a eudaimonist, and Nietzsche opposes eudaimonism. Is the term eudaimonism intelligible, or shall I explain it? Eudaimonia is the Greek word for happiness, one of the Greek words for happiness or bliss. And the whole traditional moral teaching was based on the notion of happiness or bliss, or whether of this world or the next, was a secondary question. But the key point was, about men, the highest good is happiness. And the primacy of happiness was rejected on principle by Kant. And especially German moral thought of the 19th century, including Nietzsche, is based on a rejection of happiness as a principle. And therefore, we cannot, it is misleading to compare this to Nietzsche. Now, up to this point, which is 484c, Callicles had spoken as a philosopher against the vulgar orator Socrates, who switches back and forth as it suits him between nature and convention. Now, he makes another objection to Socrates. Now he attacks Socrates precisely because he is a philosopher. 484c4. In other words, after having stated his view of the true right or law of nature, he says,
here then, you have the truth of the matter.
Yeah.
You will become convinced of it if you only let philosophy alone and pass on to more important considerations.
Of
course, Socrates, philosophy does have a certain charm, if one engages with it in one's youth and in moderation. But if one dallies overlong, it's the ruin of a fellow. If a man, however well endowed, goes on philosophizing throughout his life, he will never come to taste the experiences which a man must have if he's going to be a gentleman and have the world look up to him.
Well, again, the andra, hombre. Yeah.
You know perfectly well that philosophers know nothing about state laws and regulations. They are equally ignorant of the conversational standards that we have to adopt in dealing with our fellow men at home and abroad. Why, they are inexperienced even in human pleasures and desires. In a word, they are totally innocent of all human character. So,
yeah, in other words, they lack that psychologia, that psychology, which is absolutely necessary for politics, but also, as we have seen, for philosophy. Yes. Yes. Now he compares then philosophy, in philosophy, if practiced by people who are no longer adolescents, to someone who still uses baby talk or such things after he has become mature, and this, of course, a disgraceful and ridiculous thing. He speaks of lisping here. This is probably an allusion to Alcibiades, who was famous for his lisp. So, to repeat, after Callicles has spoken as a philosopher against the vulgar orator Socrates, he accuses Socrates of being merely a philosopher, of not having transcended philosophy. Philosophy is all right for adolescents, but in order to become a mature hombre, one must acquire experience of the major things, of the political and human things, which Socrates completely lacks, and therefore Socrates becomes ridiculous. He even deserves to be spanked, as he makes in the city. Socrates' whole way of life is the wrong one, for it is altogether unmanly. Socrates and his like are unable to defend themselves, to preserve themselves, and they become the victims of every despicable accuser. They are in a disgraceful situation. Now there is a certain, Callicles' position is not only forcefully and beautifully stated, it has also a certain strength. He takes up the point which was unreasonably neglected by Socrates, is a question of legitimate self-defense. But how does it come that he is led from this sober point that a just man should be able to defend himself by speech if he is accused by an unjust man? How does he come from this perfectly reasonable and decent view to his praise of injustice? That is, we must understand. What follows if you start from the principle, from the view that the chief consideration is self-preservation?
Well, later on, Socrates asked him, when he said, when you talk about preserving yourself and not being attacked, you mean to do this by getting as much power as possible, by either becoming the power, you know, the tyrant of a city, or being friendly with the tyrant or the ruler.
Yes, but still, do we not, have we not read occasionally a man who has the nerve of whose thought is exactly this point, the consequence of the right of self-preservation? What, I mean Hobbes, of course. What follows, according to Hobbes, from the right of self-preservation but taken by itself?
Well, on the cold level of the argument, he claims that since you can't be quite sure, you need everything. Right?
Yeah.
You made the point that he's got something more than just self-preservation in mind, that people want to not merely to preserve themselves, but, like Callicles, to live gloriously.
Yeah, but still, yeah, but in order to understand Callicles, we have to experiment with things which Callicles has perhaps never understood. And there Hobbes comes in as a great help, I believe. Because Hobbes' point is exactly this, that the right to self-observation taken by itself necessarily leads to the right to everything. And what else is injustice but to claim the right to everything? I'm not now concerned how Hobbes goes on from here, but this part of Hobbes' argument is, of course, a good help. This is quite true. Now, you made another point, Mr. Reinken. What did you say what Callicles is concerned with apart from mere self-preservation?
Well, I called it living gloriously.
Yeah.
He has pride.
Yes, there is something to that, but we will also see that in a very strange way that does not come out. That is, when he makes his initial speech, one has his impression. But this, we must watch that. I repeat that Callicles' initial attack on Socrates consists of two parts. First, an attack on justice in the name of philosophy, the name of nature. And then an attack on philosophy. And this, the justification is that for Socrates, justice is identical with philosophy. A questionable justification, but to some extent. Now, before discussing Callicles' thesis, Socrates makes a general states in a general way the conditions which must be fulfilled in a good discussion, which leads to the truth. That is at the end of 186.
If my soul happened to be golden, Callicles, don't you think I should be overjoyed to find a stone to test the metal, the best stone possible, which, when I applied it, if it agreed that my soul had been well cared for, then I would know that I was in a satisfactory state and never needed another touchstone? What is the motive behind this question, Socrates? I shall tell you. I think now that I've met you, I've met just such a lucky stone. How so? Because I am convinced that whenever you agree with me about any opinion my soul proposes, then it must be the whole truth. It is my belief that a man who is going to test a soul on the correctness or the reverse of its life must have three qualities: knowledge, goodwill, and candor.
The goodwill and benevolence would be a more literal translation. Meaning benevolence to the man to whom he speaks or whom he examines. Yes?
I run into many people unable to test me because they are not wise, as you are. Others have wisdom but won't tell me the truth because they don't care for me, as you do. And your two guests here, Gorgias and Polus, are both wise men and friends of mine, but they are somewhat deficient in candor and more modest than they should be.
More ashamed, have a greater sense of shame than they should have.
This must be so.
So in other, and the implication is Callicles has fulfilled these three conditions, and if they agree, then the thing is settled. But no such agreement could be expected in the cases of Gorgias and Polus, and therefore the previous sections are not sufficient for bringing out the truth, and in particular the truth about the soul of Socrates. The participants must be wise, benevolent to each other, and frank. These conditions are allegedly fulfilled in the Callicles section. Now, everyone would admit, I believe, that this is an ironical remark, and surely regarding Callicles' wisdom. And there is, of course, then always this great question, how do you know that it's ironical? And that would lead to, we would have to prove that. I think I would venture to say that what happens to Callicles in the sequel would show that he is not in any strict sense of the word wise. Now the consequence, of course, is that the conditions required for a settlement of that issue are not fulfilled in the whole dialogue. They are admittedly not fulfilled in the preceding part. They are in fact not fulfilled in the Callicles part. This remark here reminds of one which Socrates makes in the Republic. One can say the truth which one knows to reasonable friends. Of course, it is of no use if you say, I tell the truth and I will tell the whole truth if you don't know it. Then you can at best say, I will say what I believe is the truth. Let us disregard this unpleasant difficulty. But you, furthermore, one can say it only to friends, to people who would not use what one says against one. And in addition, they must be reasonable men, they must be able to understand. But this implies, although it is not said here, that one can say the truth that one knows only among reasonable friends. Because clearly a wise man speaks to another wise man and a non-wise man is present, God knows what this unwise man will do of what number one said. So that is clear, and this is of course of importance for all Platonic dialogues, this remark, not only for the Gorgias, as you can easily see. Now Callicles had asserted that the better or stronger should have more than the worse or weaker. But this is not very precise. Is better and stronger the same or it differs? Callicles says first, yes, they are identical. And then Socrates easily kills this view. Because the many weaklings together are by nature stronger than the few best, and even strongest, the few strongest. Now if this is so, that the multitude is stronger than the individual, however strong and so on, then it follows that the laws which are admittedly made by the many are by nature just, because they are the product of strength, which is the sole principle of natural right, according to Callicles. But the many say, of course, equal rights for all is justice. Hence, this is natural right. What can you do? The best is the same as the strongest, then the multitude always wins. Is this clear? Is this part of the modern democratic argument, his question of the sheer power of the multitude as an argument in favor of democracy is frequently noticeable. It is still remembered in the remark about ballots replacing bullets. You know where the reference to the question of power is still there. Also in Locke's argument about the right of the majority. On what is the right of the majority grounded? Fundamentally on the greater power of the majority. This is in passing. Now Callicles is then refuted in this first round. He therefore retracts his identification of the better and the stronger. He says now that the better ones are the more sensible ones. The more sensible ones should rule the others and have more than the others according to natural right. Here the question is not that the more sensible ones should rule the less sensible ones. This makes sense. But why should they have more? Why? And what does this mean? must they have such special houses so that they don't hear too much noise and can work out measures for the benefit of the people and are not disturbed by TV and so on? Or must they have more food and drink than the others? Kindness becomes and more, and also clothes, of course. What does having more mean? Kindness becomes indignant. By the better man, he understood not only the more reasonable one, but also the manly one. Manly has the meaning also of courageous, of course. So in other words, Callicles doesn't answer the question yet, what should they have more? Socrates leads him on by asking him whether the natural rulers must not also rule themselves, whether they must not control also their desires. In other words, whether apart from being manly, they must not also be moderate or temperate. In the Greek word is so for the virtue, is sophrosyne, which plays a very great role. It has a very narrow meaning, for example, in Aristotle's Ethics, where it simply means temperance regarding food, drink, and so on. But that is a very narrow meaning. It can have a very large meaning when it is understood in opposition to madness, for example, mania, in opposition to it. Then it means something like sanity, sobriety. It can also be understood in opposition to hubris, insolent pride, and then it also means something like, also like, something like sanity. But it is very common to use it in conjunction with, in distinction from, and therefore in possible opposition to manliness. For example, in the first book of Plato's Laws, there is a long discussion of the relation of these two virtues. So Socrates asks then, must these better men not also be moderate? Callicles simply denies this. The better men are those who can indulge all their desires, all their maximum desires. And this is developed again with great force by Callicles. Now, what does this mean? Callicles did not say this spontaneously, mind you, because Callicles would have said spontaneously, not egged on by Socrates, we have to figure out, we do not know this directly. Socrates pushes him into that direction so that the subject is no longer justice, strictly understood, the relation to our fellow men, but as moderation. Moderation, self-control. What did you say before, Mr. Reinken, about what Callicles is concerned with?
I claim that he had that jet of appetite.
For what?
Protest.
For what?
For more and for a glorious more. Not only shoddy, but silks.
Yeah, but still, let us avoid metaphor for the time being. And we are prepared to. Or, if you please, replace your metaphor by a non-metaphoric expression. What do you mean? What is this thing with which it's concerned? You spoke of it before. You mentioned it. Something like glory. But that is very remarkable, that he creates the impression, as if he were chiefly concerned with glory, but when it comes, when the argument is narrowed and rendered precise, it seems to be only something like the satisfaction of the bodily desire. That is remarkable, that the question of honor and prestige, whatever you call it, plays a very small role. Now, whether Callicles is not very much concerned with it, or whether Socrates manages the discussion so that this seems to be the case, that is a long question. We can perhaps later on find out the reason. Now, first of all, what is the relation between why can one try to substitute moderation or self-control for justice? Well, in the first place, a man of self-control, a man with limited desires, for possessions especially, is very likely not to interfere with other people's rights. So that from this point of view, the self-controlled man will, as a consequence, be more or less just. The other relations are with this. And here's a fundamental difference between moderation or self-control and justice. What Socrates asserts is that justice is good, good for the just man. And that means that injustice is bad for him. But if we take a very strict view and bust the case wide open, is injustice simply bad? On the lowest level. Some of you may remember the discussion of this subject in the second book of Plato's Republic, where Glaucon, a believer in justice, states a case for injustice in order to be refuted by Socrates. What was Glaucon saying? Is injustice bad? Well, Mr.
Brown. It's the appearance that's bad.
Yeah, well. Injustice is punished only when detected. And also justice is rewarded by praise or by respect only if it is known. And therefore it is possible that a perfectly just man may be regarded as unjust and suffer a terrible fate, and whereas a very unjust man who appears to be perfectly just becomes a pillar of society and is honored and respected by everyone. This is a great difficulty which Glaucon presents there. So now what about self-control? Again, on the simplest and lowest level. If someone eats too much, what is the consequence of that? Well, he will be punished for it, regardless of whether anyone sees it or not. He will be in his in strictest privacy. He will have stomach troubles. So in other words, it is much easier to prove that self-control or temperance is good than to prove that justice is good. Self-control is naturally good, whereas it is a question whether justice is naturally good. Callicles does not bring out, as we have stated before, the importance to people like him, or apparently like him, of honor and glory. Now, why is this not, we can again use a simple formula, somehow in this dialogue abstraction is made from honor or glory. But why is that done? Now, honor depends on service, true or presumed. Yeah. People are honored. Think of the astronauts, or think of the president of the United States. Whoever you take, honor is meant to be a reward for service. Service means, of course, serving others. But Callicles is concerned with ruling only for his own benefit, and he is not willing to make this concession that he should, in order to get what he wants, he should serve others. This is a characteristic of him. So in other words, if a man is concerned with honor, prestige, distinction, and so, he is more amenable in principle to consideration of justice than if he's not concerned with it. But let us pursue the argument. Callicles rejects moderation or self-control with contempt as sheer stupidity, and he defends dissoluteness, which he identifies with freedom. We can say he mistakes license for freedom. The many blame dissoluteness or license. Well, the reason is clear, sour grapes. They don't have the ability to get all these pleasant things. If anything is natural, our desires are. And that the desires are natural can easily be proven, because we desire without being told to desire. I mean, there is of course also a sham desire that people desire because it is fashion of that society to do that, we know that. But our true desires are in us without being told to desire, and also without being coerced to desire. In this double sense, desires are natural. Hence, the satisfaction of desires is in accordance with nature. The question of how one should live, as now explicitly stated, is reduced to this alternative: moderation or dissoluteness. In other words, self-sufficiency, to need nothing, versus infinite needs. Because if you must satisfy maximum desire, you are infinitely in need. Now, Socrates tries to persuade Callicles by telling him something which he has heard from a wise man who was telling myths. And according to that view, what we call life is in fact death. Or another expression from the same school, in Greek, soma sema, the body is a tomb. The body is a tomb. Now, if this is so, if what we call life is in fact death, then it follows that the desire for self-preservation is absurd. It means only to prefer death to life. Hence, of course, forensic rhetoric used for self-defense would be absurd. Now, this use of myths or of images is a kind of rhetoric, but obviously a good kind of rhetoric. From this it follows that rhetoric is not simply flattery, as Socrates had asserted. Socrates tacitly, but only tacitly, retracts here his wholesale condemnation of rhetoric. There is a kind of rhetoric which leads the soul to health and happiness, but this is here only an inference yet. It will take some time until Socrates will say it explicitly. Callicles is not persuaded by these images. He says, without needs, i.e. without desires, and their satisfaction, no pleasure. All satisfaction of desires is pleasant. And therefore, all the other consequences which he had stated. So then he says, look at another case. What about a man who has an itch and desires to scratch, and scratches to his satisfaction? Yeah, that's also good, isn't it? Callicles regards this question again as vulgarly rhetorical, but admits that a man who scratches himself will spend a pleasant, a happy life. And now Socrates takes a further step. What about the life of catamites? Now Callicles is shocked. There are things which he would be ashamed to do, and of which he would even be ashamed to speak. In other words, he is not as frank as he claimed to be. He suffers, therefore, a disgraceful defeat. For contempt of convention is his standard. But he does not give up his main thesis, which is that the good is identical with the pleasant, for this very interesting reason. In his view, it is disgraceful to abandon one's thesis. A brave man does not leave his post. But contradicting oneself is, of course, not disgraceful. In the word, Callicles cannot be reached by logos, by argument, because of his manliness. You can always, well, the simplest example, of course, is you just don't listen to what the other fellow says, and then you can never be refuted by him. Now, then Socrates makes him agree that knowledge is something different from courage, and that both knowledge and courage differ from pleasure. Yet Callicles still maintains that the good is identical with the pleasant. And here is where Socrates' argument turns around this. And what Socrates is trying to show is that by asserting that the good is identical with the pleasant, and yet that reasonableness, intelligence, understanding, manliness, and so on, are good, he contradicts himself. Is this necessarily a contradiction? I mean, could a hedonist, the man who asserts that the good is identical with the pleasant, maintain the value of courage or knowledge, although he admits that they are not in themselves pleasant? Yes.
They could be necessary means.
Exactly. So they would be not pleasant in themselves, but productive of pleasure. Now, this is of great importance for our further study, because in the Protagoras, this experiment with hedonism is made and does not fail. And so we have to keep this in mind with a view to that. Now, let us then turn to 495 at the end, E2. How the refutation goes.
Then since
our cares, our sorrows, our sufferings are of our own making, moral ills are undoubtedly the work of man, and physical ills would be nothing but for our vices which have made us liable to them.
Well, let us stop here. Moral evil is, in a way, the origin of physical evil. Yeah? Because without our vices, physical evil would not be sensible to us. Man, in his primitive simplicity, suffers barely any evils. So if we are so sensitive to evils, that's our fault. Well, of course, man in his primitive condition was not sensitive to evils because he was a stupid animal, we know. And what did he care when he had generated children and they died, and the wife he had met somewhere in the forest died? He was simply stupid. On page 244, bottom.
O man, think no further to the object of evil. Thou art evil. There is no evil but the evil you do or the evil you suffer, and both come from yourself. Evil in general can only spring from disorder, and in the order of the world I find a never-failing system. Evil in particular cases exists only in the mind of those...
It's a sentiment. Is the sentiment of the people, of the being which suffers.
Only in the sentiment of those who suffer it. And this sentiment is not the gift of nature, but the work of man himself. Pain has little power over those who, having thought level, look neither before nor after. Take away our fatal progress, take away our faults and our vices, take away man's handiwork, and all is well.
Yeah. So in other words, return to primitive simplicity is the solution to the problem of evil. Now, that this is not in any way adequate from the point of view he has stated is clear, because it is simply contradictory what he says. Because he had suggested, admittedly only suggested, not asserted, that there are two principles, God and matter. And therefore the author of evil simply cannot be merely man. He has forgotten that here. So in other words, when he comes to the moral problem, he as it were forgets this fundamental dualism. And he continues that in the sequel. When you turn to page 245, in the second paragraph, the next paragraph.
Where all is well, there is no such thing as injustice. Justice and goodness are inseparable. Now goodness is the necessary result of boundless power and of that self-love which is innate in all sentient beings.
1640, one can say, in 60 at the most, he was at the top. And later on he also, there is no further development than simply elaboration. So no conclusions, please. Now, the battles, chapter 71, and let us read the beginning of this third sentence.
Whilst the conflict was upon the water, the landmen had a conflict, and Cyrus was in their affections. They of the place contending for increase of the honor they had already gotten, and the